Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Supreme Court when we come back. Well, those who already walk submissively will say that there's no cause for alarm, but submissiveness is not our heritage. The First Amendment was designed to allow rebellion to remain as our heritage. And the Constitution was designed to keep government off the backs of the people. The Bill of Rights was added to keep the precincts of belief and expression of the press, of political and social activities free from government surveillance. Ah, the words of an anarchist. No, those are the words of Justice William O. Douglas, Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States. Now, I wished I'd have thought of that, but William O. Douglas thought of it first. Now, our princes and politicians beller in the halls of Congress for more taxes, more spending, and more gun control. But you and I haven't heard anything intelligent come out of a politician's mouth in more than 75 years. And that's why I contend that the only real reason, logic, or common sense left in America comes from our courts, not from our political process, our politicians, lawyers, or our bureaucrats. Now, old Mayor Rothschild summed it up with a flair when he said, "You give me the money power, and I care not who makes the laws." Well, give me the judicial power, and I care not who makes the laws either, because the real power in America today is in our courts. It's not in our politics. Now, if you'd like to tap into this power of the courts, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. While you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, and it's informative. Best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. Now, Courtroom Strategy and Procedure, our school, is available on compact disc for adult home education. Now, if you're online, you can also go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click on the email. Send us an email request for that free general law CD package. All right, once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now while you're thinking about it before you forget. Well, what are the legitimate federal powers then? We're talking about the Supreme Court. If there's illegitimate power that's being usurped by the court, well, then what are the legitimate federal powers? Well, Joe Ferguson was a former member of Congress from Utah. Utah is a pretty conservative state. That's one of those Republican states, one of the last three or five or nine of them, I guess. Not that Republicans in this last administration showed any conservative tendencies. If there were any, they were so well hidden I didn't see them, but they were called conservative. Well, Joe Ferguson asks and answers some questions concerning legitimate federal power. Let's see if you agree with this. The objective here is two conflicting concepts exist regarding the lawfully correct method of limiting the powers of the federal government. The first holds that the government may exercise only those powers enumerated in the Constitution, and the second, that it may exercise any powers not specifically prohibited by the Constitution. Well, of these two, let me pause here and let's get this firmly in our minds. Number one, the first legitimate concern we have is that government can only exercise those powers which are conferred to it by the Constitution. Nothing else. The second is, the government can exercise any powers that it so desires as long as the Constitution does not specifically prohibit it. Right? Now there's your two choices. We shall identify the first as Proposition A and the second as Proposition B. In application, these two concepts produced vastly different results, and whether we follow one or the other, it will have a tremendous impact upon the future of this republic and every citizen in it. The object will be to examine the arguments for and against each concept to determine which is legally, lawfully, and constitutionally correct. They cannot have it both ways. One must be compatible with the American system of law and the other hostile to it. So let's examine that question. Just try it again. This may be new to you. The way we practice it today is the federal constitution limits the power of the federal government, and the federal government only has those powers which are specifically delegated to it. Anything beyond the specific, yes, you can do this, is prohibited. The other concept is practiced by the states, and the principle of law is this. State governments have all the power in the world. There isn't any power that a state government doesn't have unless the Constitution specifically limits it. So federal and state powers, as we practice law today in the United States of America, actually practice these two objectives. Federal power is limited to those powers delegated to it, and state power is limited only by those limitations imposed upon it by its Constitution. Now, usually in examining any question, we refer to a recognized expert or authority in the pertinent field. On this subject, however, the legal experts offer theories and arguments that are so diverse and so conflicting as to prove without doubt that many persons, perhaps most, are in fact in error. In the very institution that was intended to guarantee stability, law and order, we now find that conflict and confusion reigns supreme. This situation demands that one who desires to understand the subject must set upon his own independent study and be not only meticulous but very critical in his selection of authorities. If one wishes to proceed through the entangling jungle of theories and arrive at the correct destination, he must adhere to a system which will systematically approve what is correct and disprove that which is flawed. Our system will include the examination of the following issues. 1. What is law? 2. Sovereignty. 3. The source of legitimate government powers. 4. Powers and responsibilities of the Supreme Court. 5. The confusion factor, the causes of human error in this subject. 6. Correct and incorrect methods of judicial reasoning. And 7. Whether the Supreme Court is upholding the supreme law of the land in guiding the government. Now, this system, if followed correctly, should eliminate personal and political biases and expose the flaws of many of the various theories. Hopefully, we shall proceed through the jungle to our legal and lawful destination without being detoured in the swamp of hostile theories and devoured by the crocodiles. Upon arrival at our destination, we plan to have sifted out all specious theories and be standing upon a foundation of correct principles which can withstand the most critical analysis and any storm of criticism, being solid right down to bedrock. So, now that we've examined the question, number two is, what is law? What is law? Well, the answer to the question might strike some as being so self-evident as to make the asking seem ridiculous, but the conflict of opinions among even legal experts, however, suggest that we examine and resolve this very fundamental question as it applies to the American system. A law is a rule by which any people is governed, which was established pursuant to specified procedures as set down by the sovereign. The use of specified procedures means that the law is to endure and remain in force as intended by those who crafted it until it is revoked or amended by the specified procedures. Its meaning is not subject to change by either the desires of those affected by it or the whims of those enforcing or judging it. If it were, then it would be no requirement for the adherence to specified procedures when the need is felt for change. This is true at every level of the law. In our case, the Constitution, federal statutes, state statutes, county, city, ordinances. Any change in any law made by any other than the lawfully constituted procedures and processes is understandably not lawful. It's unconstitutional. It's not legal. Now, the American system of law is unique in that it has one law, the Constitution, that is supreme to all other laws. It was established by properly authorized delegates who followed the proper procedures and was ratified by the various states. It contains a provision for change by the specified democratic process, which is clear and concise. All right, that was the second point that Joe Ferguson wanted to make. So the Constitution, when it was created by delegates that were elected by the people who met in Congress assembled and created the Constitution. There is a provision in the process itself for amendment so that if social changes occur in society, and we in the society decide that we need to make a change, there's a change to be made. There's a process. It's called amendment. Now, we've done that a time or two in this country. We woke up one day and we said that we think alcohol is bad for us and we need a constitutional amendment to abolish alcohol in this country. And we did that. It was called the Volstead Act. So we eliminated alcohol. Well, we thought we did. We intended to. All right, so time went by, and we came to another conclusion. We said, well, we think we ought to change that. And so we repealed the Volstead Act. Now, there's an example of a clear, concise modality. Social times changed. We were drinkers in this country. One day we woke up and said, no, we want to be teetotalers. And so we did. Some more time went by, and we decided we wanted to go back to becoming alcoholics again and boozers, and so we repealed the Volstead Act. So evidently, social times changed, or the social climate changed twice. Now let's take a look at the Supreme Court and the change in our public school system. We had a system here with segregation that didn't work. Well, that's what the Supreme Court said, didn't work. And so as a result of that, we had the Brown v. Board of Education case come down. Could we have done the same thing constitutionally? In other words, could we have gone to our legislature in Kansas and said, we think that we, the people of Kansas, need a constitutional amendment to include integrated public schools? I think we could have done that. Now, that isn't what we did. We went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, well, let's change it. Since Plessy doesn't work, or we don't think it works, or because we think that integration should be the rule of law here in America, and that it should not only be the rule of law in Kansas, it should be the rule of law in Alabama and California also. Let me ask you this. Could it be that when the people settled Maryland, who were primarily Catholics, could it be that those Catholics in Maryland could elect a government and form a democratic government, and then the people of Maryland could practice Catholicism to the exclusion of everybody else? because that's what the Mormons wanted to do. So they went out to Utah. Since nobody wanted them around them in Missouri or anyplace else, they went out to the wilderness, and they said, let us practice our religion out here in Utah our way. And that included polygamy. Now, the rest of you people out there are sitting there saying, well, my God, we hate polygamy. Well, okay. Okay. Nobody's forcing you to practice polygamy, but why are you prohibiting them from practicing their religious beliefs? And that's what the crux of this whole problem is. The crux of the problem is that we want to decide for other people how they live their lives. An illustration of that is in this example here with Social Lady. We come along and we say, well, we think that's child abuse. Well, who decides what child abuse is? Well, Social Lady does. See, I was raised in the era before child abuse. Now, child abuse has been going on for thousands of years. It goes on today, irrespective of the law. But today, we punish people if we catch them for it, and in times past, we never punished them. And you've probably heard many, many stories, like it was Thomas Edison, I think it was. Somebody boxed his ears, and he was deaf or hearing impaired, you know, for the rest of his life. Well, that was a bad thing to do. You know, boxing a kid's ears and causing him to go deaf, that's not good. But, you know, things happen. Now, if you take away from parents their power to discipline their children, and you reside that power in the public schools or in the social ladies or in the teachers and so on, then it takes it out of the home. Well, could it be that there are some people in America that would like to determine for themselves their own standards of child discipline and obedience and so on? Well, you can't do it here. I'm not arguing that. I already understand that. I said, could it be that maybe we ought to do that? We used to. And when we were practicing, you know, things like children should be seen and not heard, and yes, ma'am, and no, ma'am. I remember when I was a kid, you know, if you came up to an adult, and they ask you a question, you answered with yes, sir, or no, sir, or yes, ma'am, or no, ma'am. And if you didn't do that, you'd get slapped right across the face. Get a civil tongue in your head, kid. And another thing was, we never called kids kids. A kid is a goat. We called them children. Adults used to use the English language in America in a way that comported with communication, as opposed to what is the chic new, hey, like a man, like a, you know, well, a, like a, you know, man. We used to communicate on a level that actually transmitted information from one mind to another, as opposed to cliches. So I just wanted to point that out, that there was a time in America when we used to value other people's freedoms. Now, we don't do that today. Today, we are living everybody else's lives. We're living Mormon lives for them. We have concluded that those people out there cannot decide for themselves if they should or shouldn't practice polygamy. And I'm not here as an advocate for polygamy. I'm just here as an advocate for what's wrong with those people deciding for themselves what they want to do. Well, it's immoral. Well, okay, it's immoral to you. But I wanted to point out in the Bible, and this is an immoral book, the Bible, you know, the Holy Scripture. It's obviously an immoral book written by some kind of a demented, perverted God who provided for the practice of polygamy and said to one of his servants called King David, I gave you Saul's wives, plural. David had six wives. God never condemned David for practicing polygamy. Jacob had four wives. I know it's not the custom today. But then who made the custom today? Was it the God that said, I'm the God that does not change, and I'm the same yesterday, today, and forever? Or is it some other God that changes from day to day and week to week? So I just wanted to throw that out there for your consideration, because this guy Joe Ferguson is probably a Mormon. And Mormons are pretty constitutionally adept people. And they ask questions, you know, like, well, if it's good for you people, how come it ain't good for us? And so I'm not a champion here of Mormon philosophy, and I don't want you to say, well, that guy Gordon, he must be a Mormon over there because he's championing polygamy. I'm here championing the Constitution of the United States and the Scriptures. I didn't write either one of them. So don't get mad at me and send me an email now and say, hey, you crazy lunatic, right-wing, reactionary, fringe nutcase. I'm just asking the question, you know. What would be wrong with the people of Alabama deciding whether or not they wanted integrated schools in Alabama? And I want to point out something here about integration. You know, we got on this big integration kick here back in the 1950s. And the schools of America today are more segregated today by race in the United States of America, coast to coast and border to border, than they have ever been in our history today. And that's with integration. And so the segregation, integration issue is just as much alive today as it was in 1950. But it wasn't addressed by constitutional amendment. It was addressed by judicial activism. Now, maybe judicial activism is good. I'm not here to condemn it. I'm not here to champion it. I'm just here to report on it. And the guy that's taking issue with it is a guy named Joe Ferguson here in the article. But the guy that's publishing this now is called Foundations of Liberty. This comes from the East Moline Christian School, 946th Avenue, East Moline, Illinois, 61244. And this is James R. Patrick. Now, this guy, James R. Patrick, if he listens to this program, he's probably going to sit on the edge of his chair and just cringe. Because in reading this same article here, I think that they're in favor of integration. And I'm sitting here saying, well, okay, if you people in Illinois want to integrate your schools, don't you think that you could accomplish that same end by constitutional amendment, which is what these people are championing, and then let the people in Alabama do the same thing? And then somebody's going to say, yeah, but down in Alabama, they'll vote for segregation. Well, okay, so. Well, it wouldn't be fair for the blacks, so can't they move? You know, when the blacks didn't like it in the South, they moved to Chicago, didn't they? Today, there's reverse movement here going on. Black people in Chicago are now moving to Atlanta, Georgia. They're moving to the South. And so, I'm not here to condemn the people of Missouri. I live here in Missouri, and the people here make their laws, and I have to live within their laws. If it comes to a point in time, and here's where our founding fathers were champions of mobility. When the pilgrims found that living conditions in England were intolerable and they couldn't practice their religion the way they wanted to, couldn't practice life the way they wanted to, they left England and moved to the New World. Let me throw that out as a suggestion. You know, if I don't like Idaho, I can move from Idaho to Missouri. And I did. And if I don't like Missouri, I can sell out here and I can go move to some other country. I can move to some other state. So rather than for George Gordon to try to dictate to the people of Missouri how they ought to live their lives and so on by judicial activism, why don't I move out of Missouri and leave the people of Missouri to live their lives in peace the way they want to live? And let me move to another area of the country which is more conducive to the way I want to live. Now, that actually is going on right now. There's a process that we go through here. It's typically economic. And when we get tired of California and its oppressive restrictions, which is what happened to me, I moved to a more congenial state called Idaho. And I moved to Idaho, and I lived there for a long time, and enjoyed the benefits that came from living in Idaho. and millions of people in America vote with their feet. When they get fed up with the government in California, they'll move out. That's all. And you people in California that are happy and satisfied with your socialist welfare state, stay right there. But instead of you bringing your social welfare state here to Missouri, why don't you butt out and let us live our lives here, and you people live your lives there? That's why here they call these people outsiders. God, they hate them here. See, I'm an outsider. I moved here from outside. And here in our county, to give you an illustration, we don't have any building permits here. Did you know that? I mean, you can just come here to Ozark County and build a house. You don't need a building permit. Now, I know for most of you socialists and activists and communists in California, you gasp in holy righteous indignation and you say, my God, how can those people live like that? We need a law. You need to go to Washington and get a law passed by the national legislature to force the people of Ozark County to get building permits. We've been building houses here for 200 years. With that, there never has been a building permit issued in Ozark County in 200 years. And the people here seem to be happy with the process. Now, out in California, it costs $30,000 to get the permits in order to build a house. Here in Ozark County, Missouri, it doesn't cost 5 cents. And if you people in California want to spend $30,000 to get your permits in order to build a house, we don't care. We're not opposed to that. I'm not seeking legislation in Washington trying to get the people of California to repeal building permits. God love them if that's what they want. And don't you think, though, that by constitutional amendment, the people of California could determine for themselves, maybe even down to the county level, whether or not they want building permits? It's not allowed. It's not tolerated. But I wanted to throw that out there because that's what Joe Ferguson is suggesting here, is that government be limited and that the people who live in the county decide for themselves whether they want building permits. In this county, they decided, no, we don't want them. And then why don't the rest of you people in the country just leave us alone, let us live our lives? And I threw that out as a suggestion. You know, nobody's forcing you people to practice polygamy. To my knowledge, no Mormon ever came up to anybody, stuck a gun in his head, and said, hey, you know, marry this second woman or I'm going to blow your head off. No, it was all the rest of you people going out there pointing guns at the Mormons saying, hey, you can't practice your religion your way. We're going to dictate to you how to practice religion. And we're going to determine what a Christian is and what a Christian isn't, and you ain't one of us. Well, hell, they didn't want to be one of you. That's why they moved out there 1,800 miles to get as far away from the rest of you people as they could. But it wasn't far enough. As any Mormon will tell you, it wasn't far enough. And so, I guess, you know, the solution for Mormons is that you got to practice the religion of Maryland and Alabama and the rest of the Christians of America, because they've decided for you that they didn't like your religious practice. So I just thought I'd throw that one out there. Remember, when government gets so big that they can tell the Mormons that they can't practice polygamy, that government's big enough to tell you how to practice your religion too, you know. Just thought I'd throw that one out there for you. All right, with that in mind then, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review, and we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, all of which can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing will necessarily reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network, of this local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the Supreme Court and judicial legislation. Joe Ferguson here is a former representative from the state of Utah. Number three, he brings up the issue of sovereignty. Normally forgotten or ignored in examining this question, the issue of sovereignty is of paramount importance and will come into play as we progress. The sovereign is the origin of governmental power in a dictatorship. The sovereign is the origin of governmental power, period. In a dictatorship, the dictator is sovereign. Okay, so let me repeat that again so I didn't get lost here. The sovereign is the origin of governmental power, and in a dictatorship, the dictator is sovereign. God Almighty is a dictator, and he is sovereign. So if you wanted to know where the laws of God come down, you know, the guy says, I am that I am. I'm the beginning and the end, and I'm without beginning, and I'm without end. He makes a couple other statements, you know, kind of like, the heaven is my throne and the earth is my footstool. Now, most people really object to that. They don't like that kind of sovereign dictatorial power. But I'm just a reporter, so I just wanted to report that that's what dictatorial power is all about. The dictator can proclaim laws or revoke them at his will. Under the American system, the people are sovereign. We are the holders of all legitimate power. No government agency or agent is authorized to act except in accordance with the procedures, authorities, and limitations as set forth by the sovereign. Any exercise of power not authorized is illegitimate and unlawful. It is called usurpation. All right, so if you look up sovereign, it means the power to make law. It's the lawmaker. That's what a sovereign is. A sovereign is a lawmaker. So oftentimes people will call themselves sovereign. In patriot groups, you know, people say, well, I'm a sovereign citizen. And what he's saying is I'm a lawmaking citizen. That might go a little bit far. As a citizen, I have a capacity or a power to make law by contract. Contract is law. And in fact, all law is done by contract. Contract is an agreement. Contract is an offer with an acceptance over time with consideration. That's a contract. And if you'll take a look at your statutes, laws, rules, regulations, citizenship, and your relationship with government, you've got a contract here. Whether you call it that or not, it's another story, but that's what you're really dealing with. Now, number four, Joe Ferguson points out the Constitution, the only source of legitimate power. The American system of law is unique in that it includes a contract between the sovereign and the officers of government. This contract is called the Constitution. It's not just a law, it is the supreme law. And all others of government not only depend upon it for their sole role of legitimate authority, but are bound to support it. This is conclusively expressed in Article 6 of the Constitution, where it says, "This Constitution shall be the supreme law of the land. And the senators and representatives before mentioned, and all executive and judicial officers, both of the United States and of the several states, shall be bound by oath or affirmation to support this Constitution." The procedure for amending the Constitution is found in Article 5. It's the only lawful means of changing the content or intent of the Constitution or any portion of it. Any departure from the Constitution by any agent or branch of government is not legitimate, and the exercise of any power not authorized by the Constitution is usurpation. And that's the complaint being made here, is that the Supreme Court has usurped powers that were not properly delegated to it. Bottom line. And so again, the question, you know, arises, you know, where does this power come from? By whose authority is this power exercised? And what is the legitimate modality for changing the law with changing social mores? I pointed out earlier, when we decided that alcoholic consumption was immoral, we went to the constitutional process and we changed the Constitution. We amended it. Then when we decided to go back to drinking, we amended the Constitution again. That's the modality set out for doing that. Well, then, why aren't we doing that? Well, because it takes time, effort, and energy, and it's slow and expensive, and it doesn't give us the result, the desired results. So what it really boils down to is that the social engineers in control of government don't want to use the amending process because it's slow and cumbersome and doesn't give them the results that they desire. So let's use the Supreme Court to do what we want to do. That's the bottom line. Number 5, the legitimate authority of the Supreme Court. Now, the extreme importance of this question of legitimate authorities and the limitations thereof of the Supreme Court, as it bears on our central theme, will become increasingly evident as we proceed toward the conclusion. The question is surrounded by confusion, much of which has been created deliberately, because it sits at the pinnacle of the legal process. The Supreme Court wields awful power. This has lent credence to the idea that any and every pronouncement handed down by the Supreme Court is legitimate and lawful. This idea is easy to believe, because the same hand that delivers a lawful ruling has the ability to deliver an unlawful ruling, and both are delivered under presumably the same authority. But the idea is a specious myth, since it is based upon the premise that the legitimate powers of the Supreme Court are without limitations or bounds, and it fails to distinguish between legitimate authority and just plain raw power. The most challenging aspect of our examination and analysis might prove to be, perhaps, not in the determination of what is correct, but the elimination of everything that is not correct. And we hasten our progress if we will recognize right from the start this undeniable verity. There is a sharp distinction between the reality of judicial power and the legitimacy or the morality of the use of that power. Power alone has never been sufficient to produce legitimate authority. Now, Chief Justice Charles Evans Hughes might have been the first, but certainly was not the last, to pronounce the famous statement, "The Constitution is the supreme law of the land, but the Constitution is what the Supreme Court says it is." Now, whether Hughes actually believed this or not isn't known. What is known is that many judges of the Supreme Court do believe it, and this mistaken belief drives many to give the Constitution whatever meaning that they want it to have at the moment, and many Supreme Court rulings which bear the label of constitutional or unconstitutional, obviously were not derived from the Constitution itself. This prompts a view of the proper authorities of judges. We shall take these point by point. First of all, the first has been stated. They're bound by oath to observe the Constitution to be the supreme law of the land, and no justification for deviation from this oath exists. An extension of the above principle binds the court to rule unconstitutional and thereby forbid any activity by either the executive or legislative branch that is not authorized by or that is prohibited by the Constitution. C. An extension of A above forbids the judicial branch from exercising executive or legislative powers. So to clarify the latter, if the court were to depart from the Constitution, it would then be legislating instead of judging. This is strictly prohibited. This is expressed explicitly by Alexander Hamilton in the Federalist Paper, number 78. The executive not only dispenses the honors, but holds the sword of the community. The legislature not only commands the purse, but prescribes the rules by which the duties and rights of every citizen are to be regulated. The judiciary, on the contrary, has no influence over either the sword or the purse, no direction either of the strength or of the wealth of the society, and can take no active resolution whatever. It may truly be said to have neither force nor will, but merely judgment. Federalist Paper, number 78. Hamilton continued to place emphasis on the necessity of the courts being restrained to their proper sphere. It equally proves that though individual oppression may now and then, or may now and then, proceed from the courts of justice, the general liberty of the people can never be endangered from that quarter. I mean, so long as the judiciary remains truly distinct from both the legislature and the executive. Because I agree that there is no liberty if the power of judging be not separated from the legislative and executive powers. That also came from the Federalist Paper, number 78. And then D, the Supreme Court has an express duty to protect the citizens from acts of the legislature or of the executive that are in violation of the Constitution. This is expressed by Alexander Hamilton, where he said, there is no position which depends on clearer principles than that every act of a delegated authority, contrary to the tenor of the commission under which it is exercised, is valid or void. No legislative act, therefore, contrary to the Constitution can be valid. To deny this would be to affirm that the deputy is greater than the principal. A constitution is, in fact, and must be regarded by the judges as a fundamental law. It therefore belongs to them to ascertain its meaning as well as the meaning of any particular act proceeding from the legislative body. If there should happen to be an irreconcilable variance between the two, that which has the superior obligation and validity ought, of course, to be preferred, or, in other words, the Constitution ought to be preferred to the statute, the intention of the people to the intention of their agents. Again, from Federalist Paper, number 78. Now, while the above statements originate from only one of the framers of the Constitution, it can be noted that no expressions contrary to the above by any of the other framers is to be found. In other words, nobody's disagreeing with Hamilton's conclusion. The above casts in concrete, then, the lawful powers of the Supreme Court. In addition, the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court is specified in Article 3, Section 2. Neither the powers or the jurisdiction is unlimited. One of the objectives on our journey will be to determine whether the Supreme Court has confined its powers to its lawfully established parameters. The very question is so startling to some that it requires an explanation. The Supreme Court is the last step in our democratic process. There's no other body to overturn or overrule its decisions or expose the flaws therein. Therefore, the Supreme Court is free from the consequences of its malfeasance. There is no irrefutable natural law, such as the law of gravity, that requires the Supreme Court to conform to its proper duties. In this sense, it operates in a vacuum, and it can do anything and everything that the people let it get away with. True, the Constitution does provide for the removal of judges, and if certain judges were impeached for the right reason, it would certainly have a therapeutic effect upon the attitudes of the courts. As a practical matter, however, this option is seldom exercised. And this is because of the human factors in our body politic. At least four of these deserve examination as they directly bear on this subject and will be discussed. In the absence of impeachment action or the threat thereof, the only thing to restrain the court is the moral integrity of the individual judges. Whether this has proven to be sufficient will be established as we proceed. But at this point, let us just consider the possibility that the court has exceeded its authority, and then we will evaluate the evidence as we proceed. Now he goes on, number six. What is constitutional? What is unconstitutional? And what is anti-constitutional? Well, it can be clearly observed that the rulings of many judges are devoid of any similarity with or foundation in the Constitution. Yet they continue to cloak their pronouncements with the verbalism of constitutional or unconstitutional. The primary purpose the use of these words serves in these cases is to convince the general public that the rulings are based upon principles found in the Constitution, when in reality they are not. Now, as we have seen by the use of the theories of revisionism, lawyers, law school professors, and judges strive to invert perceptions of what is constitutional and what is unconstitutional. Only by doing so can they support the ongoing charade that the court is actually judging by the Constitution. The difficulty of constructing definitions and explanations for the above is their obviousness. It is a wonder that so much confusion surrounds their meanings. According to well-understood rules of the English language, the attachment of an al to a noun creates a modifier which, when used to modify another noun, attributes, characteristics of the first noun to the second. One example is the attachment of the al to origin to create original, or al to region to create regional. To state it concisely, to be constitutional is to have the characteristics of and to be in harmony with the Constitution. To be unconstitutional is to be in conflict with it. Now that in reality is as elaborate and extravagant in definition as one needs to be. So it's amazing to me the difficulty that many lawyers and judges have in understanding the obvious. The term anti-constitutional describes rulings that judges pronounce as constitutional but are in reality unconstitutional and vice versa. In each case, then, the ruling is anti-constitutional because it is contrary to the Constitution. Anti-constitutional also describes any theory of revisionism that undermines or is hostile to the Constitution or to any person whose ideology is hostile to the Constitution. So I guess the question arises, well then, are these judges actually hostile to, and are they attempting to change our Constitution by these unconstitutional means? That's a question that needs to be asked and answered. If we're not going to use the amendment process to change the Constitution to fit our social mores of the time. It was a process that we used in times past. Our Constitution has been amended many times. And at the time that we made the amendment, we came to a conclusion through our legislatures and through our votes that we needed some social change. It seemed to have worked in the past. There's a new Supreme Court justice that's about to be confirmed to the Supreme Court, who is an activist judge. We call them left-leaning activists. And Judge Scalia, on the other hand, he was being interviewed on 60 Minutes one night, and he said the Constitution isn't up for a judicial amendment. It means what it says and says what it means. Now, if Judge Scalia actually formulates his opinions based upon what it says and what it means, five justices voted for that Second Amendment. Remember, that came down last year, that the Second Amendment is an individual right. Now, we've got 25,000 laws on the books concerning guns and gun regulation. You don't need a single one of them. None. Zero. I know if you're a gun control advocate, you're sitting there saying, my God, this guy's a lunatic. Well, wait a minute. Hang on a second. The Second Amendment, if construed by the Supreme Court correctly, guarantees everybody an individual right to keep and bear arms. Now, Congress has the power to come in here and legislate. So Congress has come up and they've said, well, we're gonna regulate that right to keep and bear arms. We're going to determine for you what arms you can keep. Well, hell, if you carried that to its extreme, they could ban every gun that's made. You can have a gun if it doesn't make any noise. Well, all guns make noise. So, you know, the 25,000 regulations over here are all unconstitutional, every one of them. The Constitution says individuals have a right to keep and bear arms. Doesn't tell you, but except what Congress shall legislate to be acceptable. And so Congress comes along and says, well, here's what's acceptable and here's what isn't. And so there are limitations on your right to keep and bear arms. So there is a limitation on your constitutional rights. Is that what our founding fathers intended? So that's what this author is saying is anti-constitutional. These gun, you know, and probably well-meaning, you know, there's probably well-meaning people out there, and their belief is, Rosie O'Donnell does this, you know, she comes on the air once a month, she says, we got to ban guns. Why? Well, because they kill people. Well, good, let's ban automobiles because they kill people. You see, there's all kinds of things out there that kill people. Hell, lightning kills people. Let's ban lightning. Well, we can't ban lightning, so we'll just have to live with it. Okay. Well, the Constitution says we can't ban guns, so let's just learn to live with it. Now, it is true that guns are used to kill people, but guns aren't killing people. It's people that are killing people, and they're using guns to do it. Now, we have a law that says thou shalt not kill, and it came from the Ten Commandments. But now that we've thrown the Ten Commandment model off and adopted the Ten Plank model of amoral or immoral, well, not necessarily immoral, but at least amoral or amoral behavior, we're no longer teaching in our public schools that you should not kill people. And as a result of that, morality is suffering. And when morality suffers, then our Constitution suffers. And the reason is, our Constitution was made for a moral people. An amoral or immoral people cannot be governed by our Constitution. It won't work. That's why a moral people don't need to be told what kind of gun they can have. A moral people would not use a gun to kill somebody. Our problem isn't with guns and gun regulation, it's with morality. That's where the problem is. And you've taken a public school system, which is the 10th plank to the Communist Manifesto, and replaced the home education system. The home education system taught morality. Now, once you have taught immorality or amorality for a period of time, you're going to come up with an immoral or amoral people. Those people can no longer teach morality to their children. Not that they want to anyway, but they couldn't, even if they wanted to. And the teachers are immoral or amoral, and they cannot teach morality. Number one, it's against the law, but number two, they don't know what the hell it is to start with. How could you teach something that you don't know? It's like having a public school teacher teach arithmetic. Hell, they can't teach arithmetic. That's why Johnny can't count. They can't teach English either. That's why Johnny can't communicate. That's why Johnny comes out of public school like, hey, man, like, well, like, hey, man, that's really cool. So Johnny can't speak and he can't count. And in addition to that, he has no moral guidance to guide him. Now, take Johnny and put him on the Supreme Court of the United States. Now what do you get? Take Johnny and put him in the Congress of the United States. Now what do you get? Now you've got an immoral or amoral congressman, an immoral or amoral judge, and he can't judge righteous judgment, which was the instruction that came from God in Deuteronomy chapter 1. You have to have moral judges. Well, you can't have moral judges without morality. Where are you going to get morality? Well, it has to come from the Scripture. It comes from the Scripture. And we don't want that. All right. Well, okay, kids. Wake up and smell the coffee, because there's a result that comes from this. And that's what this author's pointing out, is that the results that we're getting over here are unconstitutional. It's worse than that. They are anti-constitutional. And that's because Johnny wasn't taught morality. Johnny went to college and got a degree in law. And now he's about to be appointed to the Supreme Court. And then when that Supreme Court justice gets onto the Supreme Court, he comes to the conclusion that the Supreme Court decides what the Constitution is. He's not restrained by it. Now, morality requires that we be restrained from the exercise of illegitimate power. In the Bible, God calls this being presumptuous. And he's mentioned that more than once, and he says, you know, this is a presumptuous fellow, taking on powers and authorities over here that he doesn't have, isn't entitled to, doesn't know how to use. And so you might want to tuck that one away in your heart and keep in mind that the Bible and the Ten Commandments and that model is an exact opposite to the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto, which we're all practicing. And public education, which is plank number 10, is the exact opposite of homeschool. And it produces an exact opposite of expansive and all-intrusive government, as opposed to a limited government that is not expansive and is not an intruding form of government. All right, with that in mind, then I'm going to have to give you a final reminder here that you have been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, and we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.